And welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the endarkened corridors of power, and more importantly, shine a light on the path ahead to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together. In other words, to address problems rather than defend positions. We have another purpose as well, and that is to provide context at a time when content can be contradictory, confusing, and overwhelming. Now, last week I mentioned an idea that has emerged, to me at least, as a meta-context for our collective awakening in this time of great crisis and opportunity. I call it the Eisenhower moment. Nearly 60 years ago, President Dwight D. Eisenhower said, "I think that the people want peace so much that one of these days governments had better get out of the way and let them have it." Last week, we spoke with Australian visionary activist Andrew Gaines about what he calls the Great Transition Initiative, a citizen-led educational movement to inspire mainstream commitment to transitioning to a life-affirming culture. Well, the idea behind his work is a global movement of movements that gathers all of our good intentions under one big intent, a world that works for each and all. My guest this week, Simon Anholt, will introduce a new worldwide platform called Good Country, which has the ambitious intention of creating and populating the world's next superpower, the awakening population of the world acting in one accord as one virtual country. Simon Anholt is an independent policy advisor. He's an author. He's worked to help develop and implement strategies for enhanced economic, political, and cultural engagement with other countries. His TED Talk on the Good Country Index has 5.5 million views, and he'll tell you today how that has led to this exciting new platform. Before I introduce Simon, I want to give a quote from the new country, the Good Country overview. Quote, "We're starting a new country, a country defined not by borders but by values, a country made up of hundreds of millions of people around the world, all motivated by a shared desire to make the world work better, a country with the power to bring about real change in the international community." Right on time. Welcome, Simon.
Hi, Steve.
Good. Well, so good to have you. Let's begin with the idea of Good Country. This obviously precedes your 2014 TED Talk. How did the Good Country idea come about?
Well, I'd been doing this job, traveling around the world, advising the governments of quite a number of countries. And I got to number 53 by the time I began to notice, rather late in the day, that they were all complaining to me of pretty much the same problems. And the last time I'd heard a truly domestic problem that was different from any problem I'd heard in any other country had been about 20 years earlier. And I also noticed that every time I asked the local experts whether there was a known solution to the particular problem that they were worried about, they always said yes. So whether it was problems caused by climate change or by migration or terrorism or pandemics, whatever it was, I said, "Do you know the solution?" And they always said yes. And so I said, being rather naive, "Well, if we know the solution, how come we're not fixing it?" And they would say, "Well, we don't have the resources." And so I, being rather naive, would say, "Well, isn't this important enough to make the resources available?" And they would point out there weren't enough resources in the entire country to solve these problems, and that in order to get the resources, they would need to collaborate with other countries. And so I, being rather naive, would say to them, so why don't you collaborate with other countries? And they would say, well, we'd lose the election. So that was the point where I began to see a pattern that it's not about climate change. It's not about pandemics or migration or terrorism, women's rights or children's rights or anything like that. It's about one big underlying problem, which is the culture of governance. The fact that nations are still configured, they were the way they were on that morning in 1683 when we started doing nationhood, as warring competing tribes. And I suddenly thought to myself, this is what we've got to change. We've got to change the underlying culture of governance from one that's fundamentally competitive to one that's fundamentally collaborative. And that's how the idea of the good country was born. Not good the opposite of bad, but good the opposite of selfish.
Very interesting. Now, I know that you, in the TED Talk that year, you had determined that Ireland was the goodest, as opposed to the best, the goodest country. What were the criteria that you used to determine what was a good country?
Well, my colleagues and I spent about 2 years, nearly 3 years, trying to collect all of the good, robust, reliable statistics we could find that measured the actual concrete outputs of countries on the rest of the system. You see, there'd been plenty of other country rankings around for many years, hundreds of them, in fact, that in one way or another measure the internal performance or state of countries looking inwards. But there'd never been an index that tried to measure their external impact on the rest of the system. A simple index that could tell you, my country, how much does it do for the world in which we live outside its own borders? Does it do more good or more harm? A balance sheet for the planet, if you like. And it took us about 2 years to find sufficient numbers of reliable, regularly repeated data sets on which we could base a credible ranking. We ended up with about 35. The majority of them come from the UN system, because the UN system is really the only organization large enough and credible enough to make measurements like these in 160-odd countries every year. And then very simply, we mash together those 35 different data sets, and it produces a series of rankings in a series of categories. So which country does the most good in terms of the global environment? Which country does the most good in terms of peace and security, in terms of the health and well-being of the human population, and so on and so forth. So it's very – yeah, go ahead, Steve.
I was going to ask, what are some of the specific ways that countries can have an impact that you measured outside of their own borders?
As I say, we have these seven categories. So if you take something like science and technology, which is one of the first ones, then we look at things like, for example, how many scientific papers are published from this country, distributed internationally and created in partnership with scientists or authors from other countries. So evidence there that you are participating in the global exchange of knowledge and science and technology. In international peace and security, for example, another one of the verticals, you lose points for killing people outside your own borders. Call me old-fashioned, but I think killing people is wrong. So you could lose ranks for doing that. And then there's planet and climate. In each of these, there are five indicators. So in planet and climate, there are your CO2 emissions. We get a lot of data from our friends at the Global Footprint Network, who calculate what each country's environmental footprint is, and so on and so forth. So it's a very, very wide variety of different data.
So if you don't kill anybody, then you're in good shape. You start out with an advantage. Which puts us probably in the U.S. at a disadvantage in some ways.
Most prosperous developed countries do have a habit of killing people in other countries. But the worst that can do is damage 1/35th of your score.
That's good to know. But the other thing, it seems like the U.S. would be, would rank up there in publishing scientific information. What about collaboration? Are we not collaborating with other countries as much as we could in that regard?
Well, no, the United States collaborates enormously in many areas. I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, I sometimes say that if the Good Country Index, every time it comes out every year, if it were really, really showing a proper representation of how the world works, the top 40 spaces would be blank, quite honestly, because even the countries that collaborate and cooperate much, much more than all the others, they're still not doing it nearly enough. They do it, it's the Nordic countries predominantly, although the Netherlands is top just at the moment. But it's still sporadic. It's still only when they really see an immediate advantage in it. And they still have to be dragged kicking and screaming. It's not their culture, that's the point. It's an occasional exercise. But I should be clear, Steve, that what I'm not talking about here is self-sacrifice or altruism, nor am I talking about charity. I mean, the idea of a nation self-sacrificing is absurd. It's preposterous. No nation could, should, or would ever do that. What we're talking about here is enlightened self-interest. It's pretty clear from all of the research that I've conducted that if countries collaborate a great deal more and compete a tiny bit less, they actually end up making better policies and actually, surprisingly enough, making more money. So this is not trading national advantage for some distant collective gain. This is actually immediate improvements in performance.
Yes, there is a quote, and I'm trying to find that quote, which actually said that the more a country collaborates, they're better able to compete.
That's right. That really seems to be the truth. There's a style of policymaking, what I sometimes call the gold standard of policymaking for the 21st century, which really hasn't been tried enough, but is where a government has the wisdom and the wit to be able to harmonize its domestic and its international responsibility. And you can do that. It's just really done not often enough.
You know, that's really interesting how there are so many people around the world who would embrace something like this. And so how did the actual, your new Good Country platform emerge from the Good Country Index?
Well, you know, I really have TED to thank for this. TED is a wonderful organization. And when I launched the Good Country Index in 2014, I did so at a TED talk in Berlin. And to my surprise and to everybody's surprise, actually, the talk did rather well. Normally talks like mine, which are just people moaning about the state of the world, don't do terribly well. And you're lucky if they get a few tens of thousands of views. But mine has, as you kindly mentioned in the introduction, has passed 5.5 million. But more interestingly, and it still gets 10,000 views a day for nearly 5 years on, but the amazing thing was the amount of correspondence it generated. And I started receiving thousands upon thousands of unsolicited emails from people all over the world, but almost literally all over the world. So after about 2 years, I realized that I had received 22,500 emails from 178 countries. And I read and answered every single one of them, as I always do. And I quickly began to notice that the people who were writing to me were saying often quite similar things. They were saying, I want to live in a good country, not a prosperous or successful or powerful country. When I travel, I want to hold up my head high and say, wow, you come from country X. That's great. We love you. You benefit the whole global community. But they also told me more personal things. Like when I was growing up, I instinctively thought that people from other countries were going to be more interesting than people from my own country. And I don't suffer from common diseases like racism and prejudice. And I think that the global challenges are generally more important than domestic challenges. And I'm fed up with domestic politics because all they do is squabble about less important things. And I've given up signing petitions and giving money to activists and NGOs because they make a lot of noise, but they don't really make a difference. And what can you do to help? And so you can't ignore people saying these things 22,500 times. So I was talking to my co-founder, Madeline, one day, and we started doing some research and trying to estimate the population that this represented. We asked ourselves, is this it? Have we heard from every single one of the 22,500 people in the world who think this way? Or are they the tip of an iceberg, and can we measure the iceberg? So cut a long story short, we measured the iceberg, and we discovered that at a very, very, very conservative estimate, no less than 10% of the world's population is a hardcore natural cosmopolitan. They believe this very, very, very deeply indeed. And I was a little bit disappointed. I said I wanted it to be 80%, but Madeline very wisely pointed out that if it had been 80%, we wouldn't have been having the conversation because there wouldn't have been any global challenges left to tackle. But she pointed out to me that, wise as ever, that 10% of the world's population is 750 million people, which is a very substantial number of people. And if that were a nation, it would be the world's third largest after India and China, more than double the size of the United States. And we began to think to ourselves, you know, maybe it already is a nation. It just doesn't know it yet. And maybe if the definition of a nation is a group of people united by a common culture, this nation is already there. And maybe all we have to do is to grant it its sovereign status and introduce its citizens to each other. And then it becomes de facto a nation. Because we live officially in the age of crazy, who says that you can't make a nation that way? And the lack of territory is to us a huge advantage. Because if you have territory, then you need an army to defend it. We don't want to have it. And our citizens, by definition, they already have somewhere to live, so we don't need to offer them a home. We need to offer them a spiritual home where they can exercise their international responsibilities, as well as a domestic home where they were born, and which is their own country, and which, of course, they are fully entitled to love as much as they want, and we expect them to. I hope we'll come on to that point. Ask me in 10 minutes' time, please, about nationalism and globalism, because I have a few queries about that, which I'd love to discuss. Anyway, well, that's pretty much the answer to the question. We decided that we were going to make this country real. People sometimes describe it as a virtual country, which I think is very rude to our citizens, because they are definitely living, breathing, three-dimensional, carbon-based life forms. There's nothing virtual about them.
Yes, what's virtual is about their ways of meeting. We're going to take a very short break in a minute or so, and then we'll be back with our friend Simon Anholt, and we're going to be talking about good country. This is Steve Behrman. We're on WikiPolitik.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
Hi, this is recording artist and composer Yuval Ron, inviting you to a voyage through the chakras, a new double album of guided meditations to transform your life, a sublime musical medicine for nourishing inner peace and reaching to your higher virtues. Get it now at metamindfulnessmusic.com, M-E-T-T-A, mindfulnessmusic.com.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket, a tent, a sandbag, a doctor, Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back with Simon Anholt, who is the creator of Good Country. Before we get back to really talking about this new platform and how it's going to unfold, I want to address the question that you just suggested, which is, you know, we're living in, people have said it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. We have this tremendous awakening, and yet there seems to be a great, I would call it an asleepening, you know, and that there's, you know, people wanting to revert back to old forms. So nationalism and globalism, particularly globalization and these nationalist movements in Europe and the USA, Brexit, et cetera, how do you contextualize all of these? How do you see this in the context of your work?
Well, two things I'd say about that. The first thing is that the Good Country is not a response to the so-called rising tide of nationalism at the moment. The idea germinated many, many years ago, and we've been working on it for an awfully long time. The current rise in the number of nationalist politicians is quite a helpful context for us to be working in, because in many ways it dramatizes this growing divide between what I once called the inwards and backwards and the outwards and forwards belief sets. But our mission, if you like, is much longer term than this. Our mission is to change the culture of governance worldwide from one that's fundamentally competitive to one that's fundamentally collaborative. And so that's, I won't say for all time, but that's for the very, very long period, way beyond our current political cycle. The other thing I wanted to say about nationalism versus globalization is that, frankly, I'm puzzled as to when, why, and how it became so widely assumed, universally assumed, that these positions have to be antagonistic. I'm puzzled by this. I'm what you might call a globalist and proud of it. It's my taste and my nature to spend most of my time worrying about the planetary issues and about the future of humanity. And one of the consequences of that is that I don't have an awful lot of time left to worry about my own country where I live. I know plenty of other people, many friends, in fact, who are exactly the other way around. They spend their time worrying about very local issues and consequently don't have much time to worry about the planet or the future of humanity. I'm glad they're there. They're glad I'm here. Where and when did this idea emerge that we have to be competing tribes and we have to hate each other? It seems to me that both sides should feel glad that the other exists. And I think we have to be very careful not to fall into the trap of tribalizing every confrontation. This is a peaceful and interesting confrontation. We don't have to tribalize it.
You know, it's interesting that you used the word competing, because my understanding is that the original meaning in Greek of the word competition was to strive together. So if we can imagine those Olympic athletes running, they're actually using one another as pace cars, as a standard to keep up with. And so what would happen if people channel that nationalism into striving together, and countries identify a sense of purpose in terms of what they want to create, use their resources and creativity and tradition to create in the world?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I think those are the right questions to ask. It's very interesting, because actually industry began demonstrating way back in the 1970s. That it's not only possible but actually beneficial for companies within a given sector to compete and to collaborate simultaneously. The automobile industry learned this from the Japanese back in the 70s, and it's worked for them for many, many decades. And I guess one of the ways of expressing the Good Country argument is that it's high time governments, national governments, started trying the same experiment, because it can work. I don't have a problem with competition. Competition is part of human nature. It's a very powerful force. It's been responsible in part for delivering many billions of people from poverty. It only becomes a problem when it's the only altar at which we worship. And that has been the case for increasingly over the last 80 years. And I think wisdom consists in understanding that it's not only possible but beneficial to harmonize your domestic and your international responsibilities. And when you start to do that, as I said before, not only do you get better results, you also make better, more interesting, more courageous, more imaginative policies. I'm not surprised or in any sense shocked when, for example, President Trump says America first. It is in many ways a statement of the obvious. It's what every national leader has pretty much always said since the beginning of time. That's what he's elected to do, of course. But what I find rather disheartening and old-fashioned is the implication, I don't know if it's his implication, but the implication of many people, that that means everybody else has to come last. And that's what I challenge.
That's really, you used the term enlightened self-interest, and I think that's really what it is. When we begin to awaken, you know, as I might have mentioned earlier, Bruce Lipton and I wrote a book called Spontaneous Evolution, and we really talk about we're really all cells in the same body. So if that's the case, if we really are all cells, it's not metaphorical, as we're finding out through learning more about the microbiome, that the same life force flows within us and without us, really. And so we really are all connected in ways, in biochemical ways that we can't even imagine. So if we were to recognize that as being true, then the question would be, well, if we really are cells in the same body, how do we behave toward one another? You know, you don't hear about the liver invading the pancreas demanding the islets of Langerhans. You know, it doesn't happen. So in this new worldwide institution that you're in the process of launching, how does a country where citizens live in every country begin to establish a sense of authority and move the dial, so to speak, on the worldwide stage?
It's a great question. Of course, we have a great many fascinating conversations with political scientists and students of international relations who ask penetrating questions about the sources of our legitimacy. And of course, we always ask questions like, you know, if you don't have a seat at the General Assembly, then where does your legitimacy come from? You can't just invent a country. Well, those are the traditional rules. But it should be obvious to everybody that the traditional rule book governing the international community, if there ever really was one, was torn up and thrown out of the window several years ago. And what we're interested in is de facto soft power influence. In other words, by virtue of the size of our population and the shared will and desire and creativity and energy and ambition of those citizens, and of course our economic hard power, because we charge our citizens just $5 a year tax. If you multiply that by 760 million, then you have $3.8 billion, which is the GDP of Sierra Leone, that we have to spend each year on projecting our influence within the international community. Luckily, we don't have Sierra Leone's problems to spend it on, because we're not trying to sustain a society. We're merely a polity, and as such, an entirely new player in the international domain. So we find this very exciting. We've sketched on our website seven broad areas of international influence that we think we could bring to bear, which range from the very soft power, the classic kind of public diplomacy and cultural relations, right the way through to surprisingly hard power based on the amount of money that we will have to spend on fixing problems. But because our watchword is cooperation and collaboration, we'll never, ever be doing anything on our own. And most of the way in which we will influence the international community will be by working together with other countries, but not just countries. Cities and regions and individuals and corporations and institutions. These are very, very exciting times to be trying new experiments in the international domain because, as I say, the rule book's gone out of the window. And it's not just nation states that have power as independent actors. There are all kinds of other institutions that do as well. And that's the sandbox that we want to play in. And we want to experiment and find new ways of achieving influence. Because all of our citizens, of course, come from somewhere else in the first place, then that also gives us a certain amount of influence within their countries. So, for example, our research tells us that in Sweden, something like 60% of the population naturally espouses the same value set as the good country. The good country philosophy passes as pretty conservative in Sweden. And that means that one day it's perfectly plausible that we might end up with 60% of the Swedish population having a second citizenship in the good country. And at that point, if the Swedish government doesn't accept that we have a certain amount of legitimacy, then, well, perhaps they should.
You know, I like the idea of this virtual country, I'm calling it that, but I mean this good country, as being a world leader in really helping all of these other countries move into a new paradigm of cooperation, and, you know, testing the waters, right, and creating successful projects. Tell us about what stage you're at now and what the launch, how you look to roll this thing out.
Well, we opened our doors very gingerly to let in a few of our First Nation about 6-8 weeks ago. And we deliberately didn't make a fuss about it because the last thing that you really want to do is to invite 760 million people to suffer and find you don't have enough forks. we're using some fairly sophisticated technology which has not been used before. We have an AI-based discussion platform which enables all of our citizens, right up to and beyond 760 million, to basically discuss and form policy together in an open, natural language, nuanced way. So the thing that we won't have to do ever is to do what conventional countries do, which is to take complex political challenges, boil them down into idiot binary questions, and then get people to vote on it. Because that's how you get Brexit, let's be honest. We will be able to preserve the nuance of these issues right the way through to the last discussion, thanks to this platform. And I think that's a very, very important step forward in the evolution of democracy. It's like being able to do the forum in ancient Athens, but with 700 million instead of 70. We are pretty excited by the potential of that, mainly because what it does is it frees us from the necessity of having a government. The good country will be a self-organizing system. It won't need leaders, and it won't need a government. So whenever anybody comes up to me and says, oh, are you going to be the president? I can put my hand on my heart and say, nope. And I've worked with enough presidents to know that that's not a job I want anyway.
You know, this is what's really excellent about this is it paces all of the work. It's probably worldwide, but here in the States, we've had people like Tom Attlee, the Co-Evolution, the Tao of Democracy, Jim Ruff, and all of these people have been conducting these wisdom councils where they've shown the wisdom of crowds that when people are brought together and instead of facing one another and facing off against one another, if they're gently led to look out in the same direction, to look at a problem that they're solving from their different points of view, then you generally get wiser decisions than you would get if you simply brought the experts in who already, quote unquote, know all the answers. So
right.
When I saw what you're doing, I see this as a huge breakthrough in even prior to nations collaborating, but citizens of the world collaborating to discover the wisdom they already have.
Up to a point, although I have to say that the wisdom of the crowds is a notion which I think has to be taken with a pinch of salt. If you're looking for example, solutions to one aspect of climate change, or ways of tackling climate change, let's put it that way, because a single solution problem there isn't. Mm-hmm. I'm not a believer in the idea that if you give people the right platform and a large enough number of ordinary non-expert people will come up with a solution. I don't think that's quite how it works. And the experts certainly do have a role to play in the good country model. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've been working on very intensively in our preparatory period is getting together the groups of experts, the think tanks, the specialists, the interested countries, the universities, and figuring out how to make them really, really make the best of their knowledge and give us their best ideas, which the citizens then discuss, review, decide how to implement. So we use experts. We use them very, very fully. But there are a couple of things that we're very, very careful of. First of all, we acknowledge that they all have bias. Bias is fine as long as you're aware of it and as long as you correct for it, which of course we do. And secondly, the other thing is that they tend to be quite dull because by virtue of being experts in their particular field over the years, they've often become experts in why nothing is possible. And so we have a sort of platform which we encourage them to use when they're working with us. It gives them a bit of hope. So we say to them, look, we're the good country. We're the only country there has ever been whose national interest is the international interest. We want you to give us policies because we want to implement them. And if your policies are good enough, and if they can really, if they're the kinds of policies that will not only achieve an effect against some global challenge or other, but also be copied and modeled abundantly by other countries all over the world, then we want those solutions. And if you give them to us, there's a very good chance we may implement them. So buck up and stop being so negative.
You know, I think here there's also the issue of, intellectual property ownership and open source. And, you know, if we're looking at ourselves as cells in the same body, open source makes a lot of sense. So how do you create that balance between I own this and sharing what you own in a collaborative, open way?
Well, nothing really starts to sound like the Communist Party manifesto, but nothing in the good country is really owned by is owned by anybody except the citizens. But for example, the good country's economy only contains money contributed by taxpayers. So those $5 that are paid by every citizen. Oh, and by the way, it's not paid by every citizen. $5 is an awful lot of money for an awful lot of people. So yeah. If you want to be a good country citizen and you don't have $5, you can ask for a tax waiver and you'll generally get it. We don't mean to test people. We just assume that they're being honest. The people who do pay their taxes can voluntarily buy $5 bonds. We call them bonds. And this creates a fund that enables us to offer free citizenship for people who don't have $5. And that particular scheme is working really well. We're now able to give away dozens of free citizenships every week, which we do. And so there's only taxpayers' money in the system. And therefore, the whole thing belongs to the citizens. There are no owners. There are no leaders. Technically, we're a 501c3, so we're a registered charity in the United States. We chose that as our launch vehicle simply because it imposes very stringent standards of transparency on all financial transactions. And that saves us the trouble of having to think of new ways of being transparent. It's just imposed on us. At some future stage, we may change our vehicle and we may just declare independence, which wouldn't be a bad thing.
Independence from the world. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Simon Anholt and the good country. Steve Behrman, this is Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
Hi, this is New Age Grammy winner Paul Avgerinos. Thanks for listening to Om Times Radio, and please support my peaceful healing music with a purchase at iTunes, Amazon, or wherever you shop for fine music. Just put my name into the search engine, Paul Avgerinos, A, V like Victor, G like George, E-R-I-N-O-S. You can also visit me at roundskymusic.com. Thanks for listening, and I'm wishing you the brightest of blessings.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Steve Behrman, we're back with our guest on WikiPolitiki, Simon Anhold. We're talking about the good country. And what I'm noticing about this wonderful country, I love this country. I want to join. It's non-coercive. There's no coercion. Yeah. Every government uses coercion. There's no coercion. You can pay taxes. If you can't afford to pay taxes, somebody else might voluntarily pay your taxes for you. So in some ways, it offers really the best of the communist and the libertarian domains here in this wonderful good country. Say some more about how it's going to operate and how many people you have as citizens so far, et cetera. And I understand why you did such a quiet, soft launch. That was a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, the statistic I always like best is the number of countries our citizens come from. And within the first 2 days, we had people signing up from 150 countries. And this is so important because it means that the next time another Westerner accuses us of being too Western, we can tell them to get stuffed. And that is incredibly important. Isn't that a funny thing, how Westerners love to accuse each other of being too Western? I've never been accused of being too Western by an Easterner, and I've never heard an Easterner accuse another Easterner of being too Eastern. It seems to be particularly Western. But anyway, so 150 countries and rising. We have, several thousand citizens already. Our aim is to get to about 200,000 by the time we have our full public launch, which will be September 2019. And that's when we'll be quite sure that all our systems are working. That's our maximum size First Nation, if you like. So the pioneers are already signing up, and we're using them to help us construct everything from writing our constitutional manifesto, which of course we'll do together. We're treading a very fine line, my co-founder Madeline and I, between preparing too much before everybody comes in and then making it look as if we've made all the decisions already, and not preparing enough so that there's nothing for people to join. Generally speaking, I think most of the people who join understand what the values are here, and they're looking forward to the prospect of being able to help define them more precisely as we move forward.
Well, that's the collaboration that really makes a lot of sense. It's not so much, discounting the experts. I appreciate your clarity about the wisdom of crowds, that certainly there's a place for the experts, and that place is to inform your citizens who want to make informed decisions. It's good that there is this common sense of the kind of world we want to create. And mm-hmm. So, in a sense, they're collaborating in creating the infrastructure of this new country. Am I correct?
That's exactly right. And this reminds me of another point that I think it's important to make, which is our tone. As you've probably gathered from the way I speak, we're not angry, and we're not activists. We're far too old and wise. Well, at least I'm old, and we're both wise. to believe that it's necessary to smash the system in order to rebuild it. We just don't have time for that. So we're working with the existing system. We're not angry with anybody particularly. I don't think we would ever, it's unlikely that we would ever censure or harass or lobby or petition another country. We want to work with other organizations to try and find the useful solutions that we can work on together. And there are some people who become citizens of the good country and who are angry about certain things. But one of the things that we talk about very often is how you really need to try to put your anger aside, because it's not a very effective way of getting things done. And it might be useful rocket fuel. It might give you the energy to want to solve the problems. But once you start solving, you have to stop being angry, because you're not going to make wise decisions, and you're not going to think calmly. So we are, above all, constructive and collaborative. We're not against the system. We're very friendly towards the United Nations, and have been since way before the project was started. We're close to 5 or 6 different UN agencies. The UN University is helping to provide us with a lot of the information about the global challenges, which we're going to share with our citizens. By the way, we also believe that an effective democracy is above all an informed democracy. So one of the things that we focus on hardest is making sure that before we start discussing and debating specific policy issues, policy areas, we make sure that everybody really, really knows what they're talking about. So after having been a citizen of a good country for a few months, you could bore for your nation on climate change or international relations or pandemics or migration or what it is, because what we are becoming better and better at is producing reliable, factual, evidence-based, neutral, non-country biased information about what's really going on in the world. And that's so valuable. It's very difficult. It's a journey. It's not a destination, but we're getting better and better at doing that.
Now, that's probably the most important thing, and certainly may be true in Europe, but certainly true in this country, that there is such mistrust of anything official, including the media, because the media has protected our government and lied on behalf of our government, to the point where those who really are liars can really insinuate their lies and say, well, look, everybody does it. So so much energy in this country has been spent until now, you know, resisting, fighting, pushing against. And when you think about it, if we are an organism, that's really a waste of energy. So what you're doing is you're simply not spending any of your energy, as my comic Swami would say, out venting, when you can spend that energy inventing instead. And that's what you're doing. You're collaborating. And I think that that really is setting a psychological, spiritual, and political tone, that there's going to be so much relief for people to find themselves not arguing, but simply educating and promoting.
Yeah, exactly right. I suppose there are three things that we offer our citizens in the good country. The first one is that we just mentioned, this idea of education, of becoming uniquely informed about what's really going on in the world. And we learned a great deal from another one of our projects, which I launched a couple of years ago, called the Global Vote, which is a platform that enables people anywhere in the world to vote on the elections of other countries. It's an open invitation to poke your nose into other countries' affairs, but more importantly, it represents the notion that if you become the head of state or head of government of any country, no matter how big, small, rich, or poor, you become part of the team that runs the planet, and that therefore who runs other countries is very important. So that's education. The second thing, perhaps the most important thing of all, is agency. So the people who've given so much time and money and energy and petitions to activist organizations, we say, now's the time to stop just making a noise. We're going to actually make a difference. You have agency within the good country. You can shorten the gap between little old me and great big world. You can actually become part of the policy-making team, and you can see the policies that you help to make being implemented. In many cases, you could be part of the implementation as well. And thirdly, after community and agency, what is for many of our citizens is the most important one of all, is community. Because if you grow up with this kind of mindset, where you think first and foremost about the whole of mankind and the whole of the planet, that can be pretty lonely. It is only 10% of the world's population. And as I said, if you grow up in Sweden, then you're a majority. There are many other countries where you're a tiny minority. And you may be the only person you've ever met who has that feeling, that view about the rest of the world. And so to know that there's a community of 760 million like-minded people, who, by the way, are pretty much all foreigners, which makes them much more interesting if you're like that in the first place, that you can be part of, and you can be part of that community, and you can share their knowledge and their experience and swap stories and swap cultures. That's the most exciting thing in the world, for us at any rate, and it's one of the reasons that drove us towards creating this thing, because ultimately that's the prize. I honestly believe that When we all walked out of Africa all those thousands of years ago and stopped being a single tribe, the whole of the story of humanity since that day has been a story of us trying to get back together again. And mm-hmm. and now we've finally achieved it, or at least we've achieved the capability to be a single tribe again. And it would be such a shame if we turned back from that or tried to turn back from that. I don't think we can, because I think it's part of human nature. I think everybody is subconsciously trying to get back together again. And now we can do it.
You know, in the Jewish culture, there's something called tikkun olam, which is the healing of the world. And healing means restoring wholeness. And so in a certain regard, as you say, that once we began looking beyond these tribes, we've been on this this quest for this whole system, not a totalitarian system, but a system that really creates, in a certain regard, ultimate freedom.
Yes, yes. And when you mention totalitarian systems, that does remind me of a point that needs clarifying. People do often say, sometimes angrily and sometimes excitedly, is this about one world government? Answer, no, this is not about one world government. Mm-hmm. Having been a policy advisor myself for a great many years, one of the few things that I really learned for sure from that experience is that government is effective in direct proportion to its closeness to the governed. And the idea of having a government that's making decisions about somebody's life 1,000 or 100,000 miles away, well, we don't have 100,000 miles on the planet, but you know what I mean. Yeah. That's a very bad idea, in my opinion. I certainly believe that the community of nations is something that needs to be reinforced and made more efficient and more effective and more fun. But the idea of governing people from vaster and vaster differences, no, for heaven's sake, most countries these days are far too big to govern anyway in any realistic way.
You know, this is a certain regard what we're moving toward in a way is self-governance as these collaborations emerge. In a certain regard, they almost preempt and preclude so many of the established institutions that are not evolved enough to handle the kinds of problems we can handle together. So, the more I read about this, the more I see myself. In fact, I'm going to sign up and have everybody else I know suggest it. Anything else about how people can? We're going to have your website on our WikiPolitiki page, both on the Om Times broadcast and then on my WikiPolitiki website. Anything else you want to share? We've got a few minutes left in regards to this project and how you see it unfolding.
Well, thank you, by the way, for all the help that you're giving us. It's very much appreciated because we are all volunteers, we are unfunded, and we're doing this out of love, and all the help that we can get from like-minded organizations is deeply appreciated. The way that we're spreading the word is through networks of volunteer ambassadors who give up a few hours a day or a few hours a week of their time to spread the word. Just talking to three or four other people, talking to their families, talking to their universities, schools, colleges, and all the rest of it. And so if any of your listeners are interested in being part of our network of volunteer ambassadors, spreading the word in North America or elsewhere in the world, we'd love to hear from them. You have to become a citizen first, and it is $5 sure. unless you don't have $5. You sign up on the website. It takes about 40 seconds. It's www.good.country, if I'm allowed the little promotion. And that's it. Then you're a citizen, and then you can get in touch, and you can say, I'd like to help spread the word. And we are just about to start putting together our North American networks. We've been focusing on Europe up until now because we're mostly based out of London. And we've got networks set up in 9, 10, 11, 12 countries so far. And it's a wonderful thing, traveling around, meeting our citizens in all of those countries. They're so different, and yet they're so similar. It's like a great big family.
Well, include me in. And by the way, I noticed that you did have an interview recently on BBC. Did you get a response from that?
Yes, we had a little spike. And the major media is starting to pay attention. Which is great, and that's very much what we need. To be honest, even if we had the money to do conventional marketing promotion, I doubt we'd do it because it would feel wrong. We want this thing to spread organically, and we want people to become part of it, not because it's trendy but because they really believe in the values and they want to put some time and some energy into making this thing work, or as we say, making the world work better. Somebody's got to take responsibility for this issue, and we hope that we won't be the only ones who do so. Well, we're not the only ones who are doing so, but we hope to be copied. It would be wonderful if in 5 or 10 years' time there were a dozen virtual countries all trying to make the world work better in their different ways.
I really, really appreciate, Simon, the work that you're doing. And I, when I saw this, this is the most heartening project I've seen in a long time, because it really is a way of aggregating, if not the wisdom, then certainly the love and the caring and the focused attention and good thinking of the people in the world who recognize that we have another destiny that is yet to be realized. So I so appreciate your work. Consider me a volunteer ambassador. And I so appreciate the idea of having this spread organically and avoid the whole areas of trying to market something when people are best find this on their own. This is Steve Behrman. We've been talking to Simon Anholt. Thank you so much, Simon. And talking about good country. This is Wiki Politiki, and we'll be with you again next week. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.